When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to the Hunting Beast Podcast, your source for hunting tactics, news, and stories. And now your host, Mario Traficante.
Hello, and welcome to Episode 4 of the Hunting Beast Podcast. Today, we will be discussing swamp hunting with well-known Hunting Beast member, Scott Shaw. All right, so welcome to this week's episode of the Hunting Beast Podcast. Today, we're happy to have another well-known member of the Hunting Beast Forum, Scott Shaw, also known as Singing Bridge on the site. Today, Scott is going to cover topics about hunting the swamp in Michigan and Upper Peninsula as well as Ontario. Scott's family has been hunting Michigan public land since the 1800s, so he's got a lot of history vested in hunting public property in Michigan. Over the years, he's been able to learn how to combat high-pressured areas in Michigan, as well as traveling to the Upper Peninsula and some more remote areas in Ontario to get on bigger bucks there. So we're happy to have him, and I think we'll get into some exciting topics about hunting the swamp. So with that, Scott, why don't you kick it off with just giving us a little bit of history about how you got into hunting and how you pattern some of your bucks.
Sounds good. Thanks, Mario. And I also want to thank you for doing these podcasts. It's really been great so far, and we appreciate it.
Sure.
I started deer hunting early on. You know, the whole family has deer hunted, both my grandfathers and my father. So I started bow hunting at age 12. That was the first year that I was actually able to hunt. And I was fortunate in that I was able to rely on, you know, experience of family members and friends to get me started. But back then, I didn't have a tree stand or tree steps or anything like that. It was just a recurve bow, no bow sight. And the first buck I took when I was age 12, I kind of ran and jumped up and caught a limb on a big white oak tree and started pulling myself up and then pulled my bow up and took a buck with my bow that way.
Nice.
The family history, yeah, I mean, we've been hunting, you know, I've got pictures from the Civil War era here in Michigan on public land, so we've got a lot of history there. We've got a lot of family members and friends that are really, you know, they're better hunters than I am. They've taken a lot bigger bucks than I have in their hunting careers. So I've always had that knowledge base to lean back on.
Yeah,
that's kind of how I got started. Yeah, go ahead.
I noticed you mentioned that on the site you've got a picture of your great-grandfather that took a buck in 1913 that was a large 300-pounder. So.
Yeah, he dressed down to over 300 pounds on a commercial scale. That's a big rack, too. He actually took that buck. He found the bedding area while he was duck hunting. He was actually traveling on a river and came across, he saw the buck. And managed to come back in with the gun later and made a good shot and got the buck. But, yeah, it's a real large buck, one of the biggest that's been taken by my family.
Nice. So is there a part of you that likes to go back to that simple style of hunting? Do you still hunt with a recurve at all, or have you kind of transitioned into more modern weapons of choice, I guess?
Yeah, I still have a recurve, but I have kind of gone the way of the compound. Recently, I've had some shoulder problems, so the compound is a little bit easier on the shooting.
Sure.
But yeah, I still have that original bow. I still shoot it once in a great while, but pretty much have gone with the compound here over the last couple of decades.
Nice. So, what are the types of areas you look for in Michigan to hunt? What areas do you focus on?
Well, my favorite area to hunt, whether it's in Michigan or in Ontario, both peninsulas, are big swamps. And I'm talking, when I say a big swamp, I'm talking square miles, thousands of acres. Those are my preferred areas to hunt. You know, I hunt a lot of public land in other areas to do some combat hunting here off home. But most of my time and experience is in those really large swamps. And I think, Mario, what I like about them the best is they're very intimidating to other hunters. Most guys really don't want to penetrate some of these really large northern conifer swamps that are flooded. You know, there's water back there that you could sink a buffalo in and never see them again.
Sure.
It's very thick, and most guys don't like not being able to see. You know, a lot of the areas that I'm in, I can only see 10 to 20 feet depending on where I'm at. And so it's pretty tough to get hunters to want to go in there, and a lot of times when they do, they get lost. So kind of what I end up with is having a lot of these big swamps to myself once I actually penetrate the interior of them. And anytime you can reduce hunting pressure, that's something that I always try to do.
Right. So you've used that over as a tactic to be able to separate yourself from other hunters and pressure.
Right. It's very seldom that I ever see a hunter near one of my stands. I've been monitoring some scrape areas, for example, for the last 30-plus years that I've taken pictures and video of, and there's never been a hunter there. And, you know, in Michigan, it's hard to imagine that places like that exist, but that's how intimidating these really big cedar swamps and conifer swamps are to most hunters.
Yeah, I can appreciate that because like I said, I just started getting into hunting more swamps since I became a member of the Beast Site, and it is intimidating walking into those bigger areas, especially when you can't see off into the horizon as you're walking in. You have to rely on your compass and a map to navigate where you're going. What are some of the things that you do to, I guess, give yourself assurance that you're on course or picking out specific spots when you're in a vast area like that?
I think probably the most intimidating thing to other hunters that are back there is once it's dark, you've got to find your way out. You have to hit your mark in these big cedar swamps. You know, you can't be off by 20 feet, or you may have to swim to get out. It's that deep and that dark. And when you can only see 10 to 20 feet, and there's just a little patch of sky up in the top of the trees, maybe you can see one star on the way out. You know, there's no distant farmhouse lights or radio towers or anything like that. You really do have to know how to navigate these spots.
Sure.
Or you're going to have a real tough time getting out. So some of the things that I look for, now I know I give you the impression that I never hunt the edges of these swamps. I think the edges of the swamps are a critical area to scout and be familiar with. And depending on the hunting pressure, some of your biggest bucks can take up shop right there.
On the edges.
Yeah, that's where you would want to start. Some of the things that I look for are transition lines where the swamp meets up against higher ground. If you can find a small point or a peninsula or something along that line, those are magnets for the bucks. If you're within a half mile of a woods road in a heavily hunted Michigan area, it's also a magnet for hunters, however. So you got to kind of try to get some distance if you're going to hunt that right up against the transition line of the swamp and the main line. If you do have a lot of hunting pressure, if you're closer to some roads, you know, there's some what I call driveway hunting. A lot of times just off of the end of those peninsulas or transition lines, there might micro island of some higher ground that they'll set up shop on, and they're really difficult to approach when they do that. But if you've got a lot of hunting pressure, those are the areas that I look for on the outer edge of these big swamps.
Right, sort of playing what the pressure is doing to the buck or moving them in a certain direction, so you're playing that.
Right, and you know, if I'm over a half mile from a road in some of my spots, a lot of times I can set up in early bow season right on the transition line where I've located some buck bedding and not have interference from other hunters. But if you are closer to a road, I think it was three Michigan bow season openers ago, you know, it's a half mile back in, actually over a half mile, into a big conifer swamp. And right at the very last light, one of the bedding areas in front of me emptied out, and I had a couple of yearling bucks and three or four does walk by me. There was no way they were going to make it out to the edge of that swamp before dark. So you've really got to kind of figure out what kind of hunt pressure you're dealing with, and that's going to determine, you know, how far these bucks penetrate. You know, my dad has always told me from a young age, if you don't bother these bucks, they like to set up on the edge and use the security and bedding of being right on the edge of the swamp. As soon as that pressure starts picking up, they'll adjust.
Right, right. So since your family has a long history of hunting these, obviously the technology that's available today, I mean, I'm assuming you probably cyber scout some of these areas in
sure.
combination with going in on foot. Did your family in the past, was there a lot more on-foot scouting that was done year-round, or would you say you keep up, you know, kind of at par with that much scouting in the off-season to find these spots?
Yeah, I've got some very, very serious hunters in my family over the years, and before we were able to really look at the aerial photos and the topo maps, you know, they were penetrating miles and miles of swamp, running it in grid patterns, drawing maps out by hand on paper, you know, figuring it out on their own. It's a lot of work. You know, most hunters don't want to invest that much work, but that's what they did.
Sure, sure. So what's a typical progression of how you scout an area that you want to access to hunt in today's sense?
Well, initially, I'll run that swamp transition and try to determine how much hunting pressure there is. You can fairly well see a sign of other hunters if they're interfering with that outer edge of the swamp. And so I'm looking for those areas that we discussed initially, the little peninsulas and points, changes in the topography. Sometimes that outer edge of the swamp will run for miles and not really have any points or peninsulas. And when I run into that, one thing that I found that the bucks do is if you look for a tree that's on that transition that's much larger and much older than the other trees, they really like to focus on bedding in that particular area. Then when I penetrate the swamp, I'm looking for areas of higher ground. And they're really not visible on topo maps. Most of the places that I hunt, you know, you're not going to find that little donut change of elevation on the topo map.
Sure.
And so I'm having to rely on other things. Aerial photographs can help me quite a bit in locating a little bit of higher ground. I'm looking for some interior transitions, maybe where some tag alders butt up against the cedars, that sort of a thing. Those are the areas that I'm looking for and where I'm going to go to look for buck bedding and activity.
So one of the things you mentioned is you look for, you know, a larger tree on that transition. Are there other specific sign that the deer may produce that you're also looking for?
Yeah, I'm real big on tracks and deer sign in general. You know, sometimes I'll find some really big rubs near bedding, but most of the older bucks in the areas that I hunt kind of bed. And then the first rubs I'll pick up are kind of off in the distance, maybe 100, 200, 300 yards away from the bed itself. I tend to find that quite a bit here in Michigan and Canada. Not a lot of bedding right in the bed. When I find an oversized bed by one of those really huge trees, And, you know, I've got droppings that the average pellet length is 3/4 of an inch to an inch. Now, that's not coming from a thong.
Sure.
And when I've got a four-finger track coming out of that bed, you know, I can pretty much put it together and know that that's a buck that I need to keep an eye on.
That makes sense. So, you're putting together multiple points, droppings, tracks, a large bed, a large change in the topography, whether it be a tree or a point that's coming off. So now when you find these areas after you've scouted, I'm assuming you're doing this in the preseason or in the off season. So are you marking these spots on a GPS for entry again?
I have marked them on a GPS. A lot of it I just commit to memory. I do keep a little notebook. I don't keep extensive notes. You know, some guys will carry around a lot of notes, a lot more than I do. But, yeah, between logging it on a GPS or in my notes or in the old hair-covered computer, one of those three ways is usually how I keep track of those areas. And those outer bedding areas that are on the transition, those are more of an early-season hunting area for me because we have so much hunting pressure. I know when I go to Canada and I'm in Ontario and I'm in a wilderness area and I'm walking into a swamp there, that's a little different. You know, I just don't have a lot of hunting pressure up there. So those outer transition areas in the swamp can be more important throughout the season. But here in Michigan, we've got some of the guys that hit the woods, you know, in gun season, over 700,000 guys are out there hunting. Penetrating the swamp then becomes more important and going to bedding areas that those bucks adjust to at that time.
How many spots do you typically have like this? Because I guess the question that kind of comes to mind to me is, how do you know when's the right time to try to go in and access one of these spots to make the kill?
Well, a lot of it is determined by whether I think a buck is a local or a transient.
Okay.
And I'll have transient bucks move into my swamps at different times of the year for various reasons. You know, the local bucks are there pretty much year-round. They leave a lot more sign. I can kind of go in and find sign of them bedding pretty much the entire year-round, even in the middle of the winter, because these cedar swamps are where they want to hang out anyway for their thermal protection and food. So those are the kind of things that I factor in when I find these bedding areas. Some bedding areas I will see become active in late October, early November, and not until then. You know, they're moving into the swamp because of the increased hunting pressure and the rut, the pre-rut, to be near those does. And so all of a sudden these bucks have moved in, and I call them transient bucks.
Sure.
So I keep track of both the locals and the transients, and there's even another set of transient bucks that move in when Michigan's gun deer season opens, and that's a whole other bedding issue, but something that we hunt and take advantage of.
Now, when you say you're observing the transients and the locals, are you using a combination of observation stands, and do you use cameras? Because I know that's a kind of a hot topic, too, about on public the use of cameras and things like that. What techniques do you use to observe them?
I'm kind of an oddball with that. I really don't get into trail cameras too much. I do own a few of them, but I don't use them a whole lot. I guess I'm really fortunate in that I'm able to interpret sign better than a lot of other guys. I'm able to go in and I can find some tracks and droppings, and I can pretty much tell if, you know, a bedding area is going to be active or not by doing a recon around the perimeter of it, but yet I'm not so close that I'm going to influence that bedding. So what I'm saying is a lot of the swamps that I hunt, there's arteries of creeks that flow through them, and I can get up and around a buck bed, check one of my known buck crossings, and if I've got that oversized print pointing towards that bed, it's, you know, pretty apparent that bed is active and I'm going to move in and hunt.
Sure. So your access point, you mentioned creeks. Are you always going in on foot, or do you also take a canoe in or a kayak in cases?
Yeah, I've taken.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey, guys. It is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun, too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino-style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Never had a kayak. I do have a Zodiac. But primarily, over the many, many years, my family and I access with hip boots. Pretty standard to see anyone in my family wearing a pair of hip boots. We're penetrating some heavy water areas and some serious muck areas. And so my standard tool for penetrating into areas where the guys don't want to go is a pair of hip boots. Sometimes we'll have to put the waders on.
Sure. This always crosses my mind in the times that I've started taking a couple-mile walk back in a swamp is, how do you deal with the inevitable, I'm going to shoot something back here, and how am I going to get it out? How have you adjusted with that?
Yeah, it's really difficult. if I've got a cold water stream, I've been far enough back, miles back into some of these really big swamps when I was a little younger. And I've, put my buck down into one of these cold creeks, tucked them under a log jam and tied them in until I could get back there the next day, after I spent hours dragging them out already. Sometimes it'll take me 12 to 14 hours to get a buck out. I don't like taking other guys back there to help me drag them out for obvious reasons. If it's a family member or a close friend, that's a different story.
Sure.
But a lot of these bucks I brought out on my own. One that I can recall in the Upper Peninsula, I shot the buck at 1:15 in the afternoon, and it was 1:30 in the afternoon the following day when I stepped out onto the two-track woods road with the buck. So, yeah, that's a long drag.
Yeah, that's a long drag. Is there any kind of tricks of the trade that you use to overcome sort of a long drag like that?
Yeah, I know that some hunters will cut them up and that sort of thing, but I never have. If I have to leave a buck and come back, one thing that I always do is I'll take off, my hat and some socks and get them scented up and put on top of the buck, that buck that I mentioned earlier that took me over 12 hours to drag out. When I went back in the next morning, the reason I left that buck behind in the middle of the night is I was just about poking my eyes out. The cover was so thick.
Sure.
So I thought, I'm going to stop here. I'm going to come back at first light and get him out. Well, when I got back there, overnight, the entire gut pile was gone, including the stomach and the stomach contents, which is very unusual. But there was no sign of gut pile. But because I had, taken the hat, the socks, got them on the buck, the coyotes and the other predators left the buck alone. So that's one of the things that I'll do. I think I mentioned earlier that I'll bury one in the creek under a log with some cold water to keep the meat cool overnight and get them out that way.
All right, so you mentioned that you'll skirt the edge of your potential bed area that you have identified, and if you see a track or droppings that let you know that there's a buck in the area that you want to target, walk me through your typical entry, your setup, and your kill process, I guess.
Yeah, if I've got experience in an area, I'll pretty much know when that buck's going to show up and I don't have to do that. But if I'm moving in on a new area that I don't have a lot of experience with, a number of years back I was talking to my friend Dan Enfold, and he said, you got to get right on top of that buck bed and in these swamps, I mean, we're already in bedding areas. But, you know, Dan, he now literally lit on top of the buck.
Right.
And so that first night I got in there and, all right, Dan, you know, put the stand on my back, got my sticks, went back there and cut a fresh buck track pointed at that bedding area. So I went in. This is a new area to me, so I didn't know exactly where the buck was, but I had a pretty good idea based on my experience in that area. And I set up, and it turned out I was just over 100 yards off the buck's bed, and I shot him about 45 minutes after I set up.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know, when Dan says be near buck bedding to catch that daylight movement, that is what I do.
So another topic that comes up in these swamps is the concept of how wind acts in the swamp and also how thermals play a role. How do you either account for that or how does that change your setups or sets? What do you do to account for that?
Yeah, I think when you're talking a smaller pocket swamp, that's more of an issue, especially if you have a change in elevation. You know, if you've got an elevation drop going down into a pocket swamp, a smaller swamp, and you've got thermals that sucking the air currents in from all directions, that's a really tough spot to hunt. And if I'm going to hunt a small spot like that, I'll usually set up kind of side current to the airflow and work from the outside in and see what I can get away with. You know, milkweed will protect you up close, but you really don't know how far your wind is going into that area. And if you're not familiar with it and know how those air currents flow through those smaller swamps, that's something that you might have to learn over time through trial and error. Sometimes I'll hear a buck blow out, move out on his own, or not see the buck, and I'll have to make an adjustment. But the really big swamps that I hunt, it's not so much of an issue if I'm penetrating deep into the swamp. I'm far enough away that the swamps are so vast and so large that the thermal effect of the swamp isn't as much of an issue as the air currents are flowing through these conifer trees in the swamp. And it's kind of like if you were pouring water into these trees, how that water was flowing through all these cedar trees or fir trees.
Yep.
And that's what you may have to learn over the course of time in a new area is where you can set up and get away with it without those bucks when they're moving, catching that air current flowing through there and picking you off. And kind of interesting, you know, when you've got an island that's back in one of these big conifer swamps, you know, it's not like a cattail marsh. You've got an island that's surrounded by trees with heavy canopy. And so even an island of high ground can actually have a thermal effect and a flow of air coming in from all of the sides. So you have to keep that in mind when you set up on a big island deep in one of these swamps that there may be a lot of swirling winds going across that area, even though you're deep in the interior.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it seems like it would be challenging because even if you looked at the prevailing wind that was going on that day that you went in, what you actually experience on foot when you get in deep into the swamp is going to be much different based on the topography that you set up in.
Right. Yeah, those are all things, and it's really important if you have time to scout these bucks out to find their exit trails and their entrance trails into the bedding area itself. You know, if you can get away from an area where there's going to be swirling winds, back out into the mainstream of the swamp itself, you've got a little bit steadier airflow and air currents going through the trees, and you can get away with a little bit more. If you're going to go up and set up on one of these big islands out in the middle of a huge conifer swamp, and you put your stand right in the middle of it, you may have some trouble with those bucks that are bedded nearby picking you off because of those swirling winds.
Sure. So is that another key thing that you identify when you look at a bed is to try to get on their exit trails and their entrance trails as part of your setup?
Yeah, it's critical in swamps. You know, when you're in a wooded swamp, you don't have any real visibility to begin with. You really need to know where those bucks are coming in and out. You know, it's not like you can see 100 yards or 200 yards. You know, you've got to be able to set up to cover that runway that buck is coming out on. You've got to find an area close enough to the bed that you can have a shot to it in that really dense and thick cover. So, yeah, it's a real important part of what I do.
So how often do you have, because I've had this happen to me now a couple times now that I've been hunting these swamps, is where I'm set up in an area where, like you say, it's low visibility to an extent, you know, you can't see far off in the distance, and you get that ever-familiar sloshing sound of, you know, a deer coming down an access trail. Is that, what does that do to you when you start hearing that sound?
Well, that's game on for me. when I was younger, I used to get pretty excited about it, and I still do, but I often do hear them coming from a long ways off. I think a lot of guys that don't have a lot of experience deep in the swamps would be surprised at how loud these big bucks are. I hear them coming a long ways off. It sounds, you know, like I've got a hunter that's lost just crashing through the swamp. But, you know, deep in those swamps, they don't encounter a lot of other hunters, so they can actually have rut activity and movement to feeding areas without encountering a lot of human scent. And the big bucks are the boss back there, and they know it.
Sure. You mentioned here in the email to me that you were able to get up on a Michigan 8-pointer and shot it at 18 feet from his bed. You want to tell a little bit about that setup and how that hunt came about?
Yeah, as I've had to adapt to hunting pressure in some of the swamps that I hunt, it's really important to get as close to the bed as you can. And that was actually a gun tactic.
Okay.
And I really don't know too many guys that do this, but what I like to do is, if I can locate a barrier inside these big swamps, the older bucks prefer to bed against a barrier. Most of the time, they want to be on the upland side of it. They'll use the super thick cover of the swamp to protect them from the backside when they're kind of looking out across the muck area or the beaver pond or the river or the creek.
Are you defining the barriers as the Beaver Creek and the river? And
yeah, something that's going to be difficult for a predator to get across without the buck knowing about it. He's also going to be watching that way. You know, most of the time they'll set up and watch downwind across that pond. And a number of bucks that I've killed that I've actually done, and it's just a tactic that I kind of developed on my own, is, for example, I'll give you one example. I came in on a beaver pond, and I knew that I had a good buck bedding up against it, the one that we were talking about in the email. And with the wind direction on that day, I had a pretty good idea of which bed he was going to be in. I came in with my rifle, with my stand on my back and a couple of sticks. And so I came in on the downwind side of the beaver pond, back in this big conifer swamp. And real quiet, took my time, got up close to the edge of the water, and I knew that he would be facing in my direction. So I got up to the edge of the water. I found a little fir tree that had a little opening in the branches about 6 feet off the ground, and I put my stand, the base of my stand was only 6 feet off the ground.
Sure.
Put a couple of sticks on the tree, kept the tree between the bedding area and me until I actually slipped onto my seat. And you really got to be in stealth mode. I try to use some cover noise when I make my moving and stand and that sort of a thing. Maybe a plane flying over or a gust of wind. I pretty much had an idea of where he was, but I couldn't see him. And then about 45 minutes before dark, he stood up in his bed on the other side of the pond, the wind blowing from him to me, and he was watching my direction.
Sure.
And that's when I saw him, and I dropped him there. And so since then, I've used that tactic several times with my gun. I'll come in on the downwind side of those muck areas or beaver pond or whatever the barrier may be. Sometimes it's a blowdown area where a tornado or some odd windstorm went through, and I've got all these trees that are down. You know, sometimes they'll come in on the backside of a small blowdown area and do the same thing. They'll be bedded up against it. And I put my stand up, shot a buck when he stood up in his bed, one that we talked about in the email, it's about 18 feet from his bed, and I shot a couple others that were less than 100 yards from his bed using that tactic.
So that's almost the perfect setup for the buck, because if they're bedding that close to the barrier downwind, I mean, if you didn't have a gun in that scenario, I mean, that's a pretty difficult set up for you to get around and hunt them any other way in close
proximity.
That's
very difficult. That's right. And even more discouraging is a lot of times what these bucks will do when they first get up, I mean, maybe only that last half hour of daylight, last 45 minutes, they'll come from their bed down to the edge of the barrier. So if you were set up with your bow, trying to get them on the other side of the barrier, the beaver pond or the water, he's actually moving away from your stand now towards the edge, and they seem to kind of like to stand there for a few minutes right on the edge of the barrier, and they just kind of look, listen, watch, and smell. They might grab a quick drink and kind of hang out there for a few minutes before they move off on their general exit trail. So, yeah, they've actually moved away from your stand and they do that before they start heading in the direction that you want them to. So, yeah, it's a difficult setup with the bow. It does happen if you can get close enough without spooking them out. I've done it, and it's not easy, though. And you can't make any mistakes. You know, we all make mistakes. I recall one big buck in that swamp that I hunted for a couple of seasons. And I had him, got a, you know, his huge track crossing this little creek and muck area, headed for that bed. I knew which bed he was going to be in. And I was probably only 70 yards off of his bed. I took a lot of time getting in there because it's so thick you can't be breaking branches or anything.
Right.
Got my stand kind of set up. I was just about ready to make my final approach for the hunt, and I stepped on the wet root of a cedar. And did a bit of a side shuffle and into a dead tree. And the big boy got up and crashed out after he snorted at me. So, you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. We learn from our mistakes and try again next time.
Right. But that's had to be a good confidence builder, though, too, because you knew he was there and you knew the setup was right.
Yeah, he was a good buck, too. I passed him as a 2- and 3-year-old. When he was a 4-year-old, when he was a 3-year-old, that's when I slipped and crashed and he blew out. And then when he was a 4-year-old, I almost got him. He took the other exit out of his bedding area. He had two primary exits that he used most of the time. One of them went directly towards a woods road and some does and some food. The other one kind of moved towards some other doe bedding areas, was a lot more secure, and I really thought he was going to use that exit that night because the hind pressure in the area picked up quite a bit. It was around Halloween.
Sure.
But I heard him get up, and I heard him walk out on the other run, which is very frustrating. I knew that was my guy going out. And then when it got to be dark, I pulled my set, and it took quite a while to get back to my truck. But interestingly enough, after I got everything packed up in my truck and drove out on the woods road, I hadn't gone an eighth of a mile, and there he was standing on the side of the road. So I actually got to drive up, put the window down, have a little conversation with him, and told him he was a pretty lucky guy. Stood there for about a minute. He was an extraordinary buck from Michigan public land, and finally, after about a minute, he trotted off. I only saw that buck one other time. I did have a local that lived up there that saw him once as a 5-year-old in the first week of November, and then he just kind of vanished. I lost track of that buck. He may have relocated, but I did not find him again.
That was almost like two gladiators nodding at each other as you were driving off a little bit.
Yeah, it's, you know, that happens to me too often. You know, it doesn't happen to him as often as it does to me, but I've had a number of bucks that's happened to me over the years.
Yeah, Dan likes to, he always likes to claim that if a buck shows himself in front of him, he's going to get an arrow in it. So
that's right.
Yeah. You talk about on here, too, in these swamps as kind of the unpredictable food sources or the changing food sources throughout the year. Can you talk a little bit about that? Either.
Yeah, that's another thing that makes it really tough.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We're at exit when these bucks are coming out of their bedding area. There may be 40 to 50 bait piles in a square mile on the other edge of the swamp where all the guys are set up. And the does make an adjustment, and the buck may make an adjustment on which way he's going to go out, based on the changing food sources that the does use. It's the food sources themselves. The bucks don't really like to eat feeder until they have to. But if they're getting pressured a lot, they'll start. And quite often in mid-November, the bucks will be maybe half their stomach might be full of cedar already. That's fairly early in the year, but they're back in the swamp. There's a lot of hung pressure, and they don't necessarily want to come out.
Is there any other food source? I mean, is there any small oak areas where you can get acorns or anything that the bucks gravitate to?
Yeah, it's mostly outside of the swamps that I hunt. There's not many oaks in the interior, these big conifer swamps in my areas anyway.
Sure.
But a lot of oaks just outside of the swamp. They'll take advantage of some red osier dogwood in the interior, some aspen, some white pine, they'll browse on all that sort of stuff. If you've got any kind of an island that's out there, you may have enough forbs, weeds and stuff early in the season that they're going to eat before they come out. But a lot of different food sources, especially for big wood swamps.
You talked about hunting high-pressure areas, and you brought up this term a couple times about combat hunts and combat hunting. Can you expand on that a little more? Just talk about how you deal with the extreme hunting pressure that you see in Michigan and what tactics or techniques that you've used to still be successful in those areas?
I have some areas that have so much hunting pressure here around my home that the 2.5-year-old buck that's, 86 to 95 inches is a really good buck for that area.
Sure.
And the three-year-olds are very rare. They may score in the one teens, maybe on a good year with a wet spring, maybe a little push, poking young. But those are exceptional bucks in some of these areas. We've got roads, here near my home on the state land, you can't go a quarter of a mile without coming across a road and hunters. So it's not like the bucks have anywhere to go. And you really need to find those overlooked spots in the combat zones where the bucks are adjusting to bed. And then, using beast-style hunting, you really need to be close to that bed to have any chance of taking them in that last half hour.
Sure.
So some of those spots that we look for in the combat zones are overlooked. For example, we've got one spot where we've got two woods roads that come together. There's no real parking area there, but there's a big blowdown area, and I've got a good buck that beds there and watches the road intersection, and no one even thinks about hunting there. They just drive through the intersection, deep ditches on both sides, and he just sits there and watches the road downwind from that. They just want to protect him on the backside where he's got a few trees knocked out there.
Sure.
So you got to kind of look for overlooked spots like that. Even in, if you can find a couple of deep ditches where they come together, that peninsula that sticks up against that wire, no one ever thinks of hunting there. And a lot of big bucks will come in and they'll bed right where those two big ditches come together, just up from it, the first good cover that they can find. Everybody's going to go into the woods and hunt elsewhere. They're not going to come back to that that little overlooked spot. So those are some of the things that we look for. But in, when I'm combat hunting, you've got to be right on top of the bedding area. Now, I've got some two-year-olds that won't even come out of the little pocket swamps until after dark. I might watch them walk 200-300 yards and stay in the water before dark. And that's only a two-year-old buck. That's how much hunting pressure we've got here. They've learned to do that. They've already got some bullets and broadheads in them. And they're very bashful. When you start getting the 3- and 4-year-olds, they're just not going to go very far. So you got to know where they're bedding.
Again, that's key to get that limited, get on them in that limited amount of movement that they make during daylight.
Yeah, you know, in these combat zones, when you've got really high hunting pressure like we have here in mid-Michigan, you know, these bucks aren't going to come out and go cruise, go bedding areas in the middle of the day. If they move 200 yards, they're shot. And so the bucks that learn that and can get to their 3rd and 4th birthday, they're not going to make that mistake. You know, they might get up an hour before dark and move around in their little safety zone a little bit, but they're not going to go very far.
So what if I'm someone that's starting out and I want to take on swamp hunting for the first time? What are sort of the top 5 things you think you would tell someone starting out for the first time and taking on the swamp?
Well, I would scout the transitions, you know, where the swamp meets up against the higher ground. You know, they're bound to find a good track or maybe a good run or some buck sign that they can set up and start. And a lot of times, if it's not overrun with hunters, they will bed right along those transitions.
Sure.
You know, they got to play the wind. But I would really emphasize that in most of the swamp areas that I hunt, the slightest change in elevation, again, we're not talking about, you may not even see it on a topo map, but the slightest change in elevation, whether it's the tallest, maturest tree in a transition line, the ground right on the base of that tree will be just maybe 4 or 5 inches higher than all the rest of the ground. Maybe it's a little micro island that you can't see in a topo map, but it's just a little bit higher than the rest of the swamp. It's 100 yards back in from the edge. Those are really the things that I would tell a new hunter to swamp hunting to look for. Any kind of an elevation change, a little bit higher ground, that's where you're going to look for bedding. That's where you need to play the wind and set up to have a crack at a swamp buck.
Okay. On the topic of tracks, because you mentioned that again, that you would look for tracks, how did you build your skill set in being able to identify tracks? What are certain things that you look for in the actual impression or in the track to maybe identify direction or size or age of the track?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm always looking for a walking track. In these really big conifer swamps that I hunt, they don't really rub off their front, their hooves a lot. The toes are a little longer, a little more pointed. You know, you get up into the bluffs that I sometimes hunt in Ontario and stuff with some big elevation, and, you know, they've got a lot more rounded, the hooves on the front.
Okay.
So a lot of times back in the big swamps, you've got some long, more pointed tracks. If it's a walking track and it's fairly wide and it's pointed towards a buck bedding area, I kind of know that that's what I'm looking for. I spent a lot of time tracking bucks in the snow. And the bucks that we're after, when you're looking for a mature buck, their tracks really stand out. You know, you can kind of, in the snow, I can kind of see a pony track going through from quite a ways off. Before I ever even get up there, I already know that it's a big buck. When you don't have snow on the ground, you know, the deep, wide impressions that I can get 4 fingers into, it's a nice walking track. And, you know, I'm already going back to where I know bucks bed anyway, so, you know, if I see that big track pointing in that direction, that's kind of what I'm looking for.
Yeah, it's just confirmation.
Yeah, and, you know, guys that want to learn how to track and stuff, you know, drive around in your public land areas on some sandy roads and start learning what you're looking for. I want to talk about trail cats real quick. I get a real kick out of this. You know, I've had some public land here at my house I do some combat hunting on. And a couple of years ago, you know, I parked my truck. I started walking down the road, And 4 days in a row, here's this big buck track crossing the Sandy Woods Road.
Okay.
And there's probably, 100 different hunters or more that drive by that track. They don't have a care in the world about that track. They're headed for their trail cameras to go try to find a big buck.
Yeah.
So, sometimes you've got to be able to see the forest from the trees. Now that, after I kept cutting, I was going to hunt a different buck, and after I kept seeing this big track crossing the road, not one hunter understood what they were driving by. So tracks to me are very important, and hunters really need to start educating themselves on, big buck tracks. Sometimes a doe will have big feet, but most of the time not. That particular buck, I didn't have any experience with them. I moved in on them. I posted this on the Beast pictures and everything. I set up where I thought I was going to be able to get a shot on them. I've never been to that bedding area before, and I got just a little bit too aggressive, just a little bit too close, and I blew him out of his bed. And I took a picture of his rub in his bed and in his bed. He was a good buck for the Michigan public land.
Sure.
But, tracks are real important. And, if you're driving by big buck tracks on the dirt roads because you're on your way to go check your trail cameras, you might want to rethink that.
Yeah, I think it brings up, it kind of brings up a good point about a little bit of the modern hunter and the technology. People like to see big deer on camera. I mean, let's face it, it excites them. You might be seeing that deer during a time in a place where you're never going to get access to actually hunt them. So, I think it's a good point about just getting on foot and actually looking for natural sign.
And you can check tracks 365 days a year. It doesn't matter if they're wearing horns or not. That big buck is leaving some big tracks.
Right.
And some big drops. Yeah. I heard Dan mention the podcast you guys were talking about droppings. That's another thing, it's amazing that hunters will drive by buck tracks and not have any idea what they're looking at. But, if you're in a swamp and you're near potential big buck bedding and you're not finding good tracks, you're not finding a big rub, but you find a pile of droppings and the average pellet length is an inch, it's probably not coming from a doe, and it's not coming from a fawn. And time after time after time, when I found the big droppings, I've walked right to a good buck's bed.
Sure. Dan and I discussed that briefly, and it makes sense, and I think it has to do with, the age and the maturity of the buck, they produce the bigger droppings.
Yeah. If it's okay, I want to talk about a little bit going through the season and the phases of the season in the big swamp. I think we already talked about early season, the little drivelies that are going back from the swamp edge. Sometimes they'll sit up right on the edge if you don't have too much pressure. And then I also mentioned that during the late pre-rut, I get some transient bucks that move into my swamps.
Yes.
Sometimes they'll sit up right on the edge of it. Sometimes they'll actually move back into the swamp itself. And those rubs and bedding areas and tracks haven't been active since the year before. So those are some transient bucks that are coming in. Another transition that I really get in the swamp, and I wanted to mention this because it's a very interesting example. The gun deer season here in Michigan, and I'm sure in Pennsylvania and the Northeast and New York and some states that really have some high pressure, I see a lot of buck movement into these swamps caused by that pressure. Bucks that had not been there before, all of a sudden, and including some mature bucks, move into these big conifer swamps. The best example that I can give, and you can never duplicate this with a radio collar study or anything like that. My father had a deep swamp blind in a big cedar swamp.
Okay.
And, it was 12 or 13 years in a row, he shot a good buck on the second day of the Michigan gun deer season. We open up on November 15th.
Okay.
On November 16th, it was 12 or 13 years in a row, almost all of them between 9 and noon, he shot a good buck in that blind. And so what we've got going on there, and he's in a deep swamp blind, he's way back there. I think a lot of the bucks that when Michigan's gun deer season opens up, the hunters swarm the uplands around these swamps, and a lot of these bucks will jump into the best cover that they can find and ride it out. But at the end of the first day of the rifle season here in Michigan, and it gets to be dark, they start moving towards these swamps. They've been there before, either during the rut or maybe when they were a fawn, but they know these swamps are there. They know that they can get away from human scent. They know that there's doe families back there, and they can actually carry on rut activity without interference from other hunters back in these giant conifer swamps. And so never on opening day of gun deer season, but on the second day, these bucks that had come into the swamp were walking transitions in between doe bedding areas with some midday cruising. And 12, 13 years in a row, that's far too much to be a coincidence.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, the other thing that I've got to support that is for a lot of years after opening day of gun deer season, after dark, we come back and eat dinner and we go for a drive and we circle these big swamps on the roads that are near the outer edge of them. And, you know, we'd see some good bucks. And they were never moving away from the swamps. They were moving towards the swamps. And I think that's what my father was seeing in his blind. In fact, one year we had a good buck run right into the side of our truck while we were doing that feed in the passenger door. So, yeah, there is some movement caused by the hunting pressure. And some of these bucks are mature bucks that are heading for deep swamp because of all the pressure.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of similarities of things that I've heard Dan talk about before in some of the public areas that he gun hunts on, you know, where people have a tendency to hunt, you know, they'll access that public area that may be bordering a swamp or a marsh, and they hunt the outskirts. They hunt the spot that's a close walk from the parking lot. And then, you know, that second day or even that afternoon of opening day, all those bucks and deer have moved into, like you said, the swamp or the marsh, the areas where no one wants to walk. And Dan's, you know, said always had some success moving into those areas and doing drives. I think he has a hard time convincing his drive crews to keep coming back year after year to go swimming in the middle of winter. But
yeah, that's a tough slog to those cattail marshes. At least you do have some visibility if you can get up above the cattails. Back in the feeder swamps, it's pretty limited.
Sure. So, I don't know if you do want to talk a little bit about some of the hunting you do up in Ontario?
Yeah, sure. I think for a lot of guys that are, you know, going to go swamp hunt, big swamp, and then maybe it's an out-of-state area or something like that, if you're going to go on a week-long hunt, one thing that I've learned is if you can spend a couple of days doing a quick recon of some areas that you've already identified that have a lot of potential, it can really pay off. And, you know, we always talk about hot sign. And what I like to do, like up in Ontario, is I'll move to some of these swamp areas and check and see if there's some good activity on the periphery. If I've got some big tracks, maybe some new rubs, maybe some scrapes with some big tracks in them, that area that I may have identified from a topo or from an aerial photo will hold more importance to me than another. And a good example of that was a big nine that I took up there. He dressed well over 200 pounds. I had moved into an area up on top of a bluff. There was a new clear cut with some aspen regrowth that might have been 6 to 8 feet high, and there were a lot of does hanging out, and that was their primary food source. And then down below the bluff, there was a small stream that ran through and went right through the middle of a really big Canadian swamp.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, you know, I'm glad that I've got the doe there. But I went down to the bottom of the bluff, found a beaver pond, found a beaver dam. Looked like a pretty good crossing. You know, I don't walk right on top of the sign either. You know, I'm staying back and looking at it from a distance. But I knew that area was hot. And after I had scouted for a couple of days, I decided that that was my best chance of a spot. There were fresh rubs, fresh grapes, a lot of good time there, doe bedding. So I moved into that swamp, and I think I hung for about 45 minutes when that big guy came through and I shot him. So I guess the point that I was making there is that if you can spend the first couple of days of your hunt doing a quick recon without actually marching right on top of where you're planning on the buck coming through, it can definitely be worth your advantage, more so than just showing up, walking out, and hunting.
And that brings up another interesting point, because I know we talked, Dan and I had talked about this before, but when you're accessing these points and you're penetrating in, do you gauge that hot sign, look at it, and set up immediately? I mean, have you had scenarios, you know, where you've crossed hot sign and then returned back? Or once you cross it, you just keep moving forward because you know you've already got your scent on it?
Yeah, now, you know, I would temper that with wilderness areas. Things can be a little bit different there, but you really don't ever want to get on to the hot sign. You know, physically standing where you're expecting the buck to come through, and I think that comes with experience.
Sure.
Dan certainly has the ability to go through an area and kind of look from a distance and recognize the potential that's there and set up, whether it's immediately or after he's done scouting a day or two later. And that's the same thing that I try to do and my family tries to do. You know, we'll go in. If I check some hot sign on the perimeter of these areas, whether it's a creek crossing or, you know, a good rub line come across in Canada, something like that, I won't go in and physically stand in the area where I expect to shoot the buck. I've already confirmed that I've got a good buck working in that area, and I'll come back either, you know, hopefully right away and take that buck.
It's a difficult thing to do because I know, I mean, I found myself when I'm walking into an area, my mind is sometimes racing and you're constantly second guessing how far you should go in and whether or not, you know, you've advanced too far. Over the years, since your family has a lot of hunting experience, were you pulling aside and said, okay, here's a certain setup and a situation and this is how you look at this sign from a distance? Or how did you kind of develop that skill set to be able to recognize sign from a distance, yeah, or a area from a distance where you think that buck is going to enter?
Yeah, I think it's an accumulation of experience. You know, I also learned it from family members and then trial error on that. And there's been plenty of bucks that I've got too close to and blown them out of their bed and that sort of a thing because I didn't set up without getting too close. So, you know, we all make those kinds of mistakes, and hopefully you try to figure out what happened and learn from it and make sure that you don't do it again. But when I expect a buck to come through a certain area or to be using an exact bedding area, you know, I keep mentioning that I'm checking on the periphery. I'm checking the entrances and exits to that area without being so close that I'm going to mess up the hunt. And to be honest, that just takes experience and time.
Right, right. Well, good. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about in regards to swamps or just certain tactics that you like to use?
Yeah, you know, swamps aren't for everyone. Because of the thickness of the cover and the wooded swamps, you just can't see very far. But because of the nature of their cover, you can rest assured that some of the oldest and largest bucks in the area will utilize them, either along them or actually inside of them. And some other points I would say about swamps are that many of the bucks that get some age on them become quite reclusive. They don't really like interacting with the other deer all the time, and they certainly don't like being around hunting activity, and so they can actually be in these swamps and have very little interaction with the other deer and with hunters. Once the other deer smell where they prefer to bed in their bedding areas, they kind of avoid those areas if that's where the the older reclusive buck wants to be. But yeah, so yeah, go ahead.
Would you say because of that, in a lot of your sets, do you find that you're not seeing a great number of deer because you're looking for that specific one?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't see a lot of deer. Most of the time, if I see a deer, it's the buck I'm targeting.
Sure.
You know, sometimes a different buck will be using the bedding area, one that I wasn't expecting. But, yeah, I don't see a lot of deer back there. And so that's another thing that you've kind of got to get used to. You know, if you're expecting to see 10 to 15 deer a day, that's just not going to happen most of the time back in those big swamps.
Yeah, that's the one thing I've noticed of hunting smaller farmland woodlots and some hill country is in the past, you know, when I was younger where I had set up stands either on field edges or on transition lines on ridges, I would see, quite often I'd see a lot of deer as they would come out to the field in the evening or, you know, travel those transition lines. But I wasn't seeing, you know, the deer that I was after. And I think
right.
I think that's a kind of an important concept for guys getting into it. You know, what do they want out of it? When I've gone in and hunted these swamps where it was more about focusing on a specific bedding area and a potential target buck that was in there, I may go 3-4 sits or more without even seeing a deer.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a definite transition there that you have to get your mind right with that and not get discouraged because you're not seeing a deer on every sit.
Right. And you know, I kind of take that for granted and forget that that's not normal for a lot of guys. The other thing I'd mentioned, Mario, about swamps is that round hunting can be really important in a conifer swamp. You know, if you're in a spot where you can get into a tree and you have some visibility, and that's certainly to your advantage and certainly how I would set up. A lot of times I'll find these bucks in an area, you know, if you can imagine the cedar canopy or the fir tree canopy being so thick that if you actually get up into the tree, you've got no visibility whatsoever.
Sure.
But down on the floor of the swamp, you do have some visibility. And again, you need to know how to play the air currents. You don't want the buck to pick you off. But last year, for example, on opening day of season, I had one of my target bucks. I'd actually gotten up into a tree stand and it was a mistake. I thought he was going to come out on a different exit from his bedding area, an area where I would have better visibility. And he was right behind my stand for probably close to 20 minutes. And if I had been on the ground, I'm confident I would have had a shot. Now, here in Michigan, for many, many years, when I first started deer hunting, we weren't allowed to gun hunt trees.
Okay.
So we had to develop our skills on the ground. And back in those cedar swamps, you know, a lot of the time, your best option actually isn't to be ground hunting. You've actually got some visibility. You're going to make a lot less noise when you set up close to those bedding areas and get a shot at the buck. So if you're in a situation where you can put a tree stand up, I do, and I take advantage of it. But also recognize that there will be situations in those big swamps where hunting on the ground is, without a doubt, the best way to go.
Now, I've tried my hat at hunting on the ground a couple times, and I haven't taken a deer yet doing it, but what kind of natural, I guess, cover and things do you look for to try to tuck yourself into? I mean, you're setting up with a little chair that you're sitting on, or are you sitting directly on the ground up against a tree, or how do you position yourself to be able to be, you know, mobile enough to draw your bow and whatnot?
Usually I'll move into a little bit of cover, maybe a tree got knocked down or something like that that's close to the buck's run. It's so thick back in those swamps, you don't have to worry too much about cover. The trick is knowing when to draw your bow and shoot. You know, when I first started bow hunting, you know, I bounced a couple of arrows off deer on the ground at 15 yards and less. But yeah, back in these swamps, you know, you want some good back cover if you can get it. You know, if you get into a blown down tree or maybe a little grove of conifer trees. Sometimes I just sit on a boat seat cushion or, you know, we've got quieter cushions now that I like to use. I haven't hunted on stools a lot. You know, I know that a lot of people do back there, and everyone will sit in a bucket or whatever, but I don't like the noise.
Sure.
They usually like to get up into a kneeling position where I'm going to shoot my ball on the ground. And I've shot a fair number of deer on the ground. And it does take a little bit of a knack to know when to draw your ball so that they don't pick you off. But fortunately, I was getting away with it at a pretty early age.
So since you're going so far back in these swamps, one thing you know we didn't cover is what do you do for safety precautions? Of you know you're heading miles back in. Are there certain things that you bring with you? And as far as having people on backup, or how do you communicate if you have to communicate with someone that you should be out at a certain time, or how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I think we have debated that as a group. You know, I know that we have on the Hunting Beast as far as what precautions you're going to take. You know, if it's, you know, if you're going to say that I have to be out by such and such a time, well, then you better make sure that, you know, it's not just because your flashlight battery died or your GPS died and now a massive search is being launched for you as a lost hunter and helicopters are taking off and that sort of thing.
Right.
So you really need to decide when you're hunting areas like that, you know, what really is an emergency, when you do need help. You know, no one wants to be lying at the bottom of a bluff with a fractured pelvis. You're not going to make it out. So I would recommend that, you know, if you have a spouse or a friend, that they have a general idea of where you're hunting, you don't have to tell them right where your stands are or anything. But the searchers at least need to have some kind of an idea of where to start looking. And, you know, designate, you know, if you're not back by midnight or the following morning, that there definitely is a problem. But quite often I will have someone that knows the general area where I'm hunting. And if I've gone overnight and I haven't showed up, then obviously there's a problem.
Right.
That doesn't really happen with me too much, fortunately. I have rescued a fair number of hunters back in these swamps and in other woods as well. And they just weren't prepared for it. They, you know, didn't understand that in these big swamps that you've got to be able to hit your mark when you're coming out at night. You know, you can't be 20 yards off. You've got to find that spot where you're going to cross on the dead tree over the big impassable muck area, that sort of a thing.
Sure.
So, yeah, you need to put an off thought in it. Don't just go out wandering into these swamps. If you're going in them for the first time, you know, have someone know where you're headed until you get more experience with it. You know, people that have been doing it their entire lives, like myself and Dan and the Cattail Marshes and things like that, you know, if we haven't shown up by the next day, there's a problem. But for most guys, someone should have a general idea of where you're headed. And if you're going to these areas in the first place, you need to know how to navigate. Now, in Canada and Ontario, I actually was penetrating so far into some areas that I actually had one of those satellite distress machines that I could set off if there was a problem. And there's no cell phone coverage in that area that I was hunting, at least not
sure.
Yet. So, you know, if you're going to do this kind of thing solo, I don't enjoy hunting with others. So people that don't enjoy hunting with others, it's more of a problem if you can't make it out. So, yeah, everybody needs to decide what's important to them. And another thing I want to point out is I had it pointed out to me years ago that, you know, I'm a swamp guy, so I'm not too worried about it. Well, if you have family at home, you know, you need to think about more than just yourself. And if you get yourself into a situation back in one of these big cattail marshes or back in one of these swamps, you know, there needs to be some type of a plan in place. But again, remember that it needs to be more than just dead flashlight batteries or dead batteries in your GPS. And you really need to be determining your situation and what a real emergency is.
Right, right. Timelines and things like that. That makes sense.
Right.
That's good advice for guys that are starting out doing this new, you know, take it seriously when you're walking back in and make sure you know what you're doing.
Yeah, you know, I always say that a big conifer swamp is no place for a greenhorn hunter. You know, it's best if you take it slow and easy and maybe try to team up with somebody that's been doing it for a while and kind of learn the ropes. You know, I have these trails that penetrate miles back into these swamps. You know, I'm not making an elephant trail with, you know, ribbons, and we fucked with track tacks everywhere, you know. And I'm actually staggering my trail because I've got, in the high pressure areas, I've got hunters that are trying to follow me in. They're trying to follow me in the snow and that sort of thing. And so my trails are staggered. I really make it so that I can't be followed. And but when it's dark and you're coming out, you definitely need to be able to hit your mark.
Very good. So I guess, you know, in closing, maybe tell us about your favorite, most memorable hunt. You've obviously had a big history of hunting a variety of different deer and places. So what's your most memorable to date?
I think the most memorable is probably that Upper Peninsula hunt where, you know, it was 2.5 hours in hip boots to get to my stand, a 12.5 hour drag. The amount of effort and work and skill that it took to get that 9-point out of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and to actually get them out to the road, that's probably my most memorable hunt. When you work that hard for something, you tend to remember it.
And would you say that the lessons learned and the experience of doing that, you know, outweigh the size of the buck's rack? I mean, in the end, you know, it's the memory of the experience going through it.
Yeah, definitely. You know, that's what I remember. I don't get too hung up on rack size or anything like that. A lot of the areas out here in Mid-Michigan, we don't have big racks versus the age of the buck anyway. You know, it's we kind of, if a buck presses out over 200 pounds, that's kind of a bigger deal to us. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, I've got friends and family that take enormous sucks. Some of the biggest you can take. But, yeah, it's the memories of the hunt, the work that you put into it, the successes and the failures. You know, that's what I remember.
Very good. Well, Scott, I appreciate you taking the time and talking with us. This was a lot of good information. And it sounds like you're a guy that likes to get back deep into the swamp and get on some adventures. I think I'd have fun being your sidekick for a couple days walking through.
I've definitely had a few adventures.
So, well, all right. Thank you again. And as usual, you guys, if you have questions for Scott, we'll have this up on the Hunting Beast site. You can post questions, and I'm sure Scott will be happy to answer back and post pictures and any diagrams of things that you want. And again, I appreciate your time, Scott, and have a good weekend.
Thanks, Mario. I appreciate it.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That concludes today's podcast episode. Please go to thehuntingbeast.com to post any discussions, questions, or comments regarding today's podcast episode.